Welcome to the Mindfulness Podcast. This is David Black. I am pleased to have guest Dr. Rita Sleiman, faculty member of Sports Sciences and the Institute of Movement Science at Aix-Marseille University in France. Her research focuses on cognition and motor control in humans and changes due to aging. More recently, she has investigated the effects of mindfulness meditation on both cognitive performance and, in a second study, motor control. And we'll try to get through these two. Welcome, Rita. It's great to have you in France right now, hosted together on Zoom. So before we get to your study, I'm really interested to hear about your research. You have a PT degree, physical therapy degree, from what I understand, and your focus in sports science. So tell me just briefly about that background and then bridge it with mindfulness training, where you've come recently.
Yeah, sure. Well, first, I want to thank you for this opportunity to discuss and also for the amazing work you're doing to spread the mindfulness research results, because like this is much needed to draw awareness about the scientific part of this discipline and also like to encourage all the what we like to call the evidence-based practice, which is really much needed. So yeah, I do have a license in physical therapy. I started off as a physical therapist, and I surfed on the wave of this evidence-based current to go into more scientific research, and I ended up doing a PhD in movement science. And then follow it by a postdoc in neuroscience. In the beginning of my research interest, this was more focused on rehabilitation because it was in line with my practice. And then, well, I did my full transition towards more fundamental and applied research, mostly in the study of aging. Neurobehavioral dynamics changes related to aging, and also a lot about the interactions between cognition and motor control. And more recently, I've been interested in mindfulness meditation as part of moderating interventions to improve performance, but as well to prevent cognitive and psychological declines related to different conditions such as aging. But as well, we had a study about the pandemics in student and all of this. So, yeah.
So, well, I'm glad you're joining partially this field, because it's in the fringes that the most interesting stuff appears to happen. And so you're bringing this awesome toolkit of information about motor behavior and cognition and performance. So that's why I really wanted to talk to you about the study. So your study is published in Plus One. That's the name of the journal, where you investigated mindfulness meditation and you looked at cognitive performance in meditators and people who are referred to as novices. Those are not meditators. So what kind of gap did you aim to address here? We're always trying to like fill some gap or address a problem. What were you trying to do here?
Yeah, so maybe quickly, as an element of background, I would like to specify that this is part of a doctoral work that was defended by Luis de Villars-Reolonge, who's also on the paper, and who I co-supervised with Professor Tom Prado. And the genesis of this research interest into mindfulness meditation, and especially the study, is actually it came from when I first discovered all the literature about mindfulness meditation. I was kind of divided between the amazement of how such a simple practice can induce a large spectrum of benefits. At the behavioral, but also at the physiological level, and how much there is inconsistencies as well in the literature. Because usually when there's a new emergent field, we always say like, yeah, more studies are needed. But then it seems like as the years go by, the studies are accumulating and we have a lot of inconsistencies and questions to like draw some final conclusions. And for me, it was crucial to go back to a fundamental study where things are methodologically controlled. I tried to understand, like, you know, as the first step, the mechanisms of action of meditation, especially with regard to the effects on cognition, because this is essentially what's in the core of this practice, the attentional regulation and emotional regulation related to this practice. So this is why we wanted to first question like how these fundamental cognitive functions are stimulated through practice and very well constrained or controlled experiment. And this is why also maybe you want to go there about the investigation of what we call the acute effects or the effects of brief intervention. So this is following one session.
Yeah, so you looked at that single session, a mindfulness meditation, and you tested the effect on cognitive performance. You particularly used the Stroop task. Can you talk a little bit about that task? I always forget about what that task does. I should remember this every time, but of course, many of us aren't going to know what the Stroop task is because it's very sciencey. So what is the Stroop task and how is this relevant to human performance?
Well, the Stroop, as I said, that we were dealing with acute effects. So this is something that would happen in a more transitory phase following the intervention. So we cannot allow ourselves to go like for several tests for 4 hours. The thing is that the duration of the effects are not can be transient and it's not really known. So the idea was to pick one test that can be broad spectrum, but at the same time that can be robust in terms of test retest effects. And the Stroop task is a well-known test in psychology to evaluate some authors more related to inhibition performance and others to more cognitive flexibility. But in general, it's related to attentional control, cognitive flexibility and inhibition because it consists in showing the participants. So what we used is a word color test version of the Stroop task. So the participant were shown words of color or neutral words in different color fonts, and they were required to respond using the first letter on a modified keyboard of the to identify the color. And through the different condition, whether the word is neutral or a word of color, that reinforces the response of the color itself or that is incongruent, so it creates conflict with the written word of the or the ink of the color, then we are either in a neutral condition or in a facilitation condition, because here we are interpreting the semantic of the word and this is reinforcing our detection capability of detecting the color, or on the contrary, we are in a reflexive manner interpreting the color, the semantics, and then this interferes with our ability to detect the color. So in this task, we acquire the response time or the reaction time that the participant would take in order to between the moment he sees the word on the screen and the moment he pushes the correct key button. So we only take the the correct trials where the response was correct.
Yeah, so there's a computer-based computer-based
exactly.
task. And imagine to simplify. Sometimes I imagine, here in the States, I don't know what your walk or stop signs look like, but we have ones that when they're red, it's like a hand that's shown, and the person who's about to walk knows to step off the curb or not. But I imagine this test could, as a metaphor, the hand would be it should be a stop, but the hand is green, and the person would look at that and there'd be kind of this delay and confusion about the correct behavior. That's kind of akin.
Well,
we
only
about.
Have colors.
Yeah,
we
exactly.
Only have colors, but as like, but for example, in Berlin, they have you can have a person, like a different person. And it's true that when I first saw this, it was like I need to interpret the color plus like the sign that is showing. And this is part of it when the information can be incongruent, or at least like, you know, you have to process both information, like what's behind the symbolic and then the color, the color itself. So yeah, the choice of the Stroop task was especially because it's proven to be robust, but it also it can relate to this aspect of processing multiple information and being having this capability to selectively attend to the relevant information of the to the task. So on the one hand, and on the other hand is to inhibit this the processing or the reflexive response that we would usually do because it's easier and faster to interpret the semantics than the color.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. Us sciencey folks sometimes get too much in the weeds, and so I'm using that stop sign metaphor to make things easy because it's so it is intuitive when we see something and we've developed a contingency over such a long time. Like every time we see that hand that's red, we've now associated both hand and red. And then if one time in the future we see the green hand, we're going to be slightly confused for a minute. And there's going to be this dissonance that you're talking about. That's going to eat up time. That's going to eat up
for sure. It's gonna,
memory. Yes. That's going to eat up whatever that thing we're doing when we're trying to make a decision.
Yeah,
great.
This is the interference effect.
That thing called interference. Yeah, very
cool.
So okay,
then
so
if we're capable, and this, the it's we have this interference, and then this, the amplitude of this interference, this is what we actually were looking at. It's like, you know, how much we are distracted by this interference and how much we are capable of taking advantage of a facilitation effect when we have this congruent condition.
Yeah, and that's useful in the real world. So you don't just stand there at the curb for the next 20 minutes. You have to ultimately make a decision when there's that congruence in our world. So yeah, a very laboratory-based test for something that has practical use for sure. You also measured heart rate, correct, in this study?
Yeah.
And what's the relevance there connecting to your aims?
Well, actually, we wanted to... because if I go back to the moderators of the or the potential moderators of the effects related to meditation that we wanted to control, one of them was the capability of following the session, because you would give someone an exercise to do, and then you would give them instructions. And when it's related to physical performance, it's easy. You can see whether the task is done and to which extent it's the instructions are being respected. But when it's like a covered behavior that is happening inside of the mind of the participant, here it's difficult to see what's happening. And then it's difficult to judge afterhand if the lack of effect is related to the fact that the intervention wasn't effective or to the fact that actually the participant wasn't able to follow instructions. And to control for this, we did as it's usually done. We used a self-reported questionnaire to make sure, like, you know, it's like whether the participant feel that they managed to follow the instructions at several points. And we wanted also like some easy physiological measures. And well, there's no perfect measure for this, but if we look at several studies, we can see that like the heart rate is one of the indicators that can show the or that correlates with what is reported in terms of the state of mindfulness induced by meditation. And this is why we wanted to control this, or at least to record this, in addition to asking the participants to report their experience following the session.
So yeah, this is important because you're asking someone to do this skill. And as you said, it's so important. We call this term covert. It's like when you see an athlete with this, you presume there's a big emotion and they're leaning their head against, like, let's say it's basketball. We have our big basketball finals going on right now. And people would say something's happening there. Some big emotion must be happening inside this person, but we don't know. Right. You'll never know. We just make the assumption that we're seeing something and that something's going on in that person, that organism. So in science, we really need something important like this, right? Like heart rate, to determine at least that if we expect there's a deeper breathing, slower respiration rate, slower heart rate, that they're actually doing the thing we're asking them to do, not just sitting there and thinking about the next vacation they want to go on.
Because even if when we ask them, there's always a potential bias related to the expectation of the like the desirability bias towards like I want to be positive and like reassure the experimenter that I did well, or I'm just afraid of the judgment that I'm gonna have. So even the self-reported measure can always include the bias, and having a physiological measure, and when we see that both converge, it's rather reassuring for us in terms of to interpret the results afterwards.
Yeah, that's good. So validating that they were doing what you actually asked them to do. Does this heart rate also change during the Stroop? Because you're demanding something of them. And I wonder if there's anything there to confirm that they're engaged in the task as well.
Well, actually, the heart rate that we measured at baseline when they arrive and after they familiarized with everything. And so it was the baseline resting state heart rate. And then we measured it during both interventions, because we had also a control intervention. And then we measured it afterwards, but we did not measure it during the Stroop task. And actually the question was not as much how the heart rate will be affected following the session. It was more like during the session relative to baseline. So this is, did they achieve this quiescent state like during the meditation? Was it comparable to the control intervention, or even more important than in the control intervention?
Okay, that's important. So who were the participants? What did they experience? We know they did the Stroop. We know they meditated, or I forgot what they did in the controls. What did they do in the controls?
And the participants, as you said at the beginning, there were two groups. So the what we call the novices, so the meditation naive, they never meditated. And then there was the more the regular meditator. And there we had it was quite variable, the meditation experience, because for us it wasn't looking at what experience will do. It's just like being sure that the participants were familiar with this practice, and they will be able to follow the simple exercise that we're giving them. So their experience in meditation was meditating regularly for at least once a week for the last 2 months, I think, if I'm not mistaken. So this was the minimum required. But then there was more expert meditators as well. And for the control intervention, then, well, it's always critical to choose the control intervention in science, because we want to be confident about the conclusions that we can make of our results. And then we want to control everything, but at the same time, keep our study feasible. And what we chose as a control intervention was what we call it's an active control, because we were expecting that it could induce also an effect. And it was listening to a podcast. And they were required, so of the same duration, using the same pace of speech as in the, and the same voice of in the guided meditation intervention. And they were required to listen carefully to the podcast or to the recording. And they were told that they will be asked questions about it later on. And the idea was that to control for the sustained and selective attention that is required to follow any verbal instructions, which is not something that is specific to mindfulness meditation. So there we had an intervention. They had to be attentive first for the same amount as the time required for their mindfulness exercise. And so we hope that this would enable us to control for the non-specific attentional regulation that are not specific to the meditation exercise.
Yeah, and this is super important because you have your meditation group listening to something that alone could have a stimulating effect. Then you have your control, who you also want to listen to something, or else they're not equivalent. So they are listening.
Actually,
that's super important.
I need to correct something because it's not really a group, a control group and a control an experimental group, because it was the same group. He wanted to, it's one other thing that he wanted to control for is the individual response to mindfulness, because some persons would be more or less prone to respond to this intervention. And we were wondering whether this could explain the discrepancies observed in the literature, because there would be like, it wouldn't be an equivalence between those who are in the control group and those who are following the intervention. And we wanted then to, we adopted like a repeated measure or within subject design. So it was the same person who did both interventions, and we counterbalanced the order of the interventions, and we kept enough time in order for the effects also to potentially fade away.
And that makes sense. You wanted the same person to be exposed to multiple conditions.
Yeah,
that's what we
so
were
then,
meaning by within
they
subject.
They will be their own control. Exactly. So each participant is their own control.
And that's even better, right? Because there's so many other factors. If you're comparing groups, for people who don't know design, they're bringing all kinds of unique stuff, unique things to a study that are at this individual level. So if you give the same person different exposures, it's meaningful because you saw how they responded under one condition, and then you watch again how they respond under another condition. So overall, how did you interpret your results? You're seeing these people experience these two conditions. These are both auditory stimuli. One is meditation focused. The other is just attention, like listening.
Exactly.
And what do you find?
So what we found is that more importantly, is that there was no effect of meditation experience. So all the results that we observed were independent of meditation experience. And both novices and meditators improved their reaction times in this troop task following both interventions, but more so, significantly more so, following the mindfulness meditation intervention. And this was the case especially for the troop condition when there was either an interference, so a conflict between the color and the meaning of the word that was shown on the screen, and also in the condition when there was a facilitation effect, so it was in accordance both. So those who meditate, so when they meditated, the participants were able to better exploit this facilitation effect and to better inhibit the interference, and so it had like a more limited effects on their behavior. So they managed to keep a better performance in this task and these two conditions. And when we looked at their capability of following the task, as judged by the scores of the questionnaires that we used, we found that it was they had, like, all participants had good scores, and this was also coherent with what we saw in terms of heart rate results. So the heart rates were was lower than baseline in both after both interventions, but more significantly so in after the meditation intervention. So we were reassured that they managed to follow this exercise, which was actually like a simple fundamental breathing exercise. So it wasn't that complicated.
So excellent. So for the public, if you had one line to say about practical implication related to either human performance or intervention technologies, the potential there, what might it be?
Well, maybe one short take-home message would be that, like, this intervention, this mental intervention based on attentional regulation and this attitude of opening and acceptance that we can, with several simple exercises that we can take from mindfulness meditation discipline, can be very useful to improve one performance. And this is something that is feasible and easy to perform and to take advantage from, even without the need of previous experience or the need of long sessions. So the idea of what we hear from the public that, like, this is not for me, or it's it needs a lot of practice. Of course, there would be a dose, a relation between the dose and the effects observed. But I think it's already reassuring that this is something that can be useful in different setups with very little constraints.
Great. And I know we're running out of time here. Thank you so much for your time. I wanted to bring up just a final note. You put, in the meantime of us talking about this meeting, you brought out another study. And I'm really excited about the study as well, because it relates mindfulness meditation to hand coordination. So we have, like, this physical capacity. We're calling this, you know, generally motor behavior. And it's a really good model to be exploring the effects of meditation on behavior. Could you briefly tell us just a summary of that study? And maybe we can guide people to reading that study as well.
Yeah, sure. Thank you for bringing it up. So this second study was about the benefits that we can expect from mindfulness meditation on the control of complex movements through maybe the improvement of cognitive control. Because we know, like, there's no simple motor task that doesn't require minimal cognitive investment. Even walking, that is considered as an automatic task. It includes as well, it relies on cognitive resources. And the idea was to use bimanual coordination task at a certain what we call parallel movements. So it was the hands were doing opposite movements at a very high frequency, which is, we call the transition frequency, at which usually it's difficult to maintain this pattern because would be more will be spontaneously transitioning to something that is more symmetrical. And the idea was to see if after meditation, the participant would be able to better control, so better stabilize their motor behavior, and then opposed to this spontaneous transition. So this is one question. And the other question was to know whether this was related to their cognitive improvement following meditation. And there we checked their performance on an attentional task and on an inhibition task, wherein we had separate score, one score for perceptual inhibition, so the capacity to inhibit relevant information, and the motor inhibition, which was the capacity to inhibit the automatic prevalent response that was not required for the task. And there we had two groups, a control group following an attentive listening intervention. So this was, again, a podcast with questions at the end. And we had the experimental group following a 15-minute mindfulness meditation session. And in terms of results, what we observed is indeed there was better performance. It was better performance after both intervention in terms of in what relates to attentional control. So they managed, both groups managed to stabilize their coordination between the hands following the attentive listening and the meditation intervention. But regarding inhibition, which is more, was shown to be more specific to the meditation exercise, there we only seen significant differences at in the experimental group, so those who meditated. And there again, in all our results, once again, we did not find any effect of the experience, previous experience in meditation. So both novices and meditators showed similar patterns of, or comparable patterns of results.
So in that's awesome and well-received study. And just putting that for the public in the motor behavior terms, like, are we through a training going to be able to perform more complex motor behavior with their hands to a better degree after a meditation training? Or,
well, in many motor tasks, then what we call complex tasks, when we have to coordinate multiple degrees of freedom and at the same time process perceptual information related to the task or to the environment or to other participants in the task or like different constraints in the environment, we need to select the relevant information and we need to select also the relevant response. And it looks like this, at least from this. So it's a lab task, a laboratory task that we used, but we consider that this task is like an example, an illustration of what happens in real life. And it looks like this capability that have been shown in terms of cognitive functioning to select the relevant information and inhibit the irrelevant information is also beneficial for motor behavior. And when we looked at the correlation or the mediation link between cognitive improvement and motor improvement, we actually did not find a statistically significant link. Suggesting that there is something more, it's like the cognition that is directly embedded in the motor behavior that seems to be improved by meditation. And there is very few studies actually that were interested in the motor benefits of mindfulness meditation. And here it's like, you know, very, very promising in terms of this first result.
Well, thank you so much, Rita, for sharing your work. Let's conclude for today. And I wish you all the best on your journey in this area. Listeners could subscribe to our podcast at goamra.org. Bye now.